Thank you, Joy. I'll make this very short. Ruth Jarman graduated in chemistry from the University of Oxford and worked in the semiconductor industry. She works now, as Joy said, for Green Christian, an organization which was founded 38 years ago to share Christian insights with the Green Movement and to encourage Christians to live and act in environmentally conscious ways. Ruth is a trustee of Operation Noah, which she co-founded in 2010, as she saw the need for a Christian campaign group to focus exclusively on climate change. With others, in 2011, she started Christian Climate Action. She is also very involved locally in her community and in her church in many practical activities to do with climate change. She is married with three children and worships at St. John's Church in Hartley Wintney in Northeast Hampshire. So Ruth, thank you for coming this evening to talk to us on the subject, A Christian Response to the Ecological Emergency.
Thank you, everybody. Can everybody see this? Can everybody see the screen, or do you need me to read every word that is on the screen? Can you all see it? Sorry, I need my glasses on to be able to see you, to see whether you can. Yeah, is that? And there's nobody that needs it read every word. Thank you. And can you hear me? Okay. Okay. Good. Next slide. Thank you, Richard. These feelings here are normal reactions to being confronted with the existential threat of ecological crisis. If you have been following climate change for some time, you may have been grappling with these. Do I need to do? Is this on? Do I need to turn that one off? How do you turn it off? It's a red light on, but okay, that's not the problem. Okay, I'll just carry on, shall I? So these feelings here are normal reactions when confronted with what I'm going to talk about today, I'm afraid. You may have been grappling with them for a while, or they may come as a shock today. Either way, you're not alone. And the charity I work for is actually developing help for people to work through the fears which the evidence can provoke. There will be time at the end of the meeting to express feelings which I hope will be helpful. And I will also talk about what people can do, which for many people is very, taking action is very therapeutic. Next one, thank you. I wouldn't call myself a prophet, but I do believe I belong to a prophetic community speaking uncomfortable truths to this generation. And I'm very thankful and pleasantly surprised that so many of you are here, and perhaps consider for yourself whether you are part of this prophetic community as well, or you'd like to join it. Because the world needs to know the reality of the precarious situation we are in. I'm starting off with biodiversity. October last year, a major international report from WWF told us that populations of vertebrates declined by an average of 60% since 1970. And then in May this year, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, I'm sure they could have thought of a better name, came out with this report, press release. And if an environmental group had come up with this, I think they would have been told they were using language that was too over the top and too much doom and gloom. But this is a prestigious international scientific body, and they say that nature's dangerous decline is unprecedented, species extinction rate is accelerating, we are eroding the very foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide. And the essential interconnected web of life on Earth is getting smaller and increasingly frayed. The report didn't include insects, and anyone who drives a car knows that they are declining rapidly too. Sorry, next slide, thanks. But they did say that 1 million species are now threatened with extinction, and that includes all the favourites, basically. For me, these were created by God to praise God by being what they are and doing what they do. In Genesis, God saw that it was good 5 times before he created humans. So I think these have innate worth, whether that has nothing to do with their usefulness to us. And under business as usual, they are pretty much doomed. But the report does tell us what we have to do to prevent their extinction. Transformational changes must start now, at every level, from local to global. And by transformational changes, they mean fundamental system-wide reorganization across technologies, economic and social factors, including paradigms, goals and values, steering away from the current limited paradigm of economic growth. This is what eco-nutters like me have been calling for decades. And, you know, I used to feel we were naive and unrealistic to be asking for human values to change. But here is a prestigious international body calling for a complete transformation in how we live, how we inhabit this world, and also calling into question the number one goal of our current economic system. Which brings me to one of my favourite cartoons. Something you environmentalists have to understand is that the destruction of the planet may be the price we have to pay for a healthy economy. The next slide, please. And then there's the small matter of climate change. And we know we are in a bit of a bind. This is what our world leaders tell us. Okay, next one. Yes, thanks. One of the main reasons for the rich biodiversity of life on Earth is the atmosphere. The layer of gas is just the right thickness and just the right mix of gases to allow ice at the poles and hot, steamy rainforests at the equator. And if we didn't have this layer of greenhouse gases, the Earth would be 30 degrees colder and would be completely lifeless. I first heard about climate change while reading chemistry at Oxford 35 years ago. I thought then that humanity would do something about it, but I'm still waiting. There are two ways to sort of look at the global temperatures. There's observations, which work really well for past and present, but they're not very good to tell you what's going to happen in the future. So we need a second way, and that's through modelling. And that is the only way we can look into the future. And the way you test the model is by seeing how well it fits with the observations. So I need a pointy thing. So what we've got here is the dots are observations. So they're actually what happened in the past from 1850 to now. Those little dots is what the global temperature was. The top orange line is the model of what the amount of concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere should give us in terms of global temperature. So that's a human-induced number. Humans have caused that orange line. But humans have also caused the sort of dark blue line at the bottom there that's actually getting slightly less, that bringing the temperature down, and that's the aerosols we have put into the atmosphere by burning woods, by burning forests, and by coal-fired power stations, basically. And so that is reducing by reflecting light and energy back into space, that's reducing the temperature. And then the yellow and the blue are natural changes in temperature. The blue one is volcanoes and solar. And can anyone tell me why there was a dip around 1883? Yay, well done. And another dip around 1995. That was Montserrat, yes, that's right. So when you get volcanoes, you get a reduction in the temperature, again, because of the aerosol, of the reflecting of the dust back into space. And then the yellow is the El Nino effect, so that's just a cyclical change. And then the scientists added up all these models, and the total expected global warming, because of all these different affects components of temperature is the grey, the thick grey line there, which pretty much follows the observed numbers. So we can say that as long as past changes are the sort of changes you might expect in future, we can be pretty confident of the scientists' predictions. Just generally, that temperature is still going up, obviously. We've just had the hottest June on record. It's crazy now. We're probably going to have the hottest July in record. People are dying because of heat. In the Indian state of Bihar, 180 people died last month. It was 63 degrees in the sun in Kuwait the other day. I find 30 degrees quite hot enough. So what is the world doing about this? Well, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was set up by the UN in 1988. And their job is to look at the published scientific literature and determine the scientific consensus and then make recommendations to policymakers. And in their latest report, which came out in October last year, they recommended staying below 1.5 degrees higher than the pre-industrial and making sure by making sure that CO2 emissions reached net zero by 2050 globally. We have to note that the IPCC is not just a scientific, but it's also a political body. And the agreements that people sign up to, the Paris Agreement, for example, is a political agreement rather than a legal agreement. So specific climate goals are politically encouraged rather than legally binding. So they're not much more than a voluntary agreement. So we just go into just one of the conclusions of the 2018 report. The first one here, the reason for concern one, which is the reason for concern for unique and threatened systems. So this is coral reefs, rainforests, the Arctic, and glaciers. The temperature as you go up, this is global temperatures going up along the side. The grey bar across the middle is the temperature between 2008 and 2015. So we're just above that grey bar is where we are now. So where we are now, just above that grey bar, about 1 degree temperature rise, we are already at moderate risk for these unique and threatened systems. If we go to 1.5 degrees, which is what the IPCC is asking us to do and many people say is impossible, that is high risk for the unique and threatened systems. 2.5 degrees is very high risk. And this really matters because these are biodiversity hotspots. So this is God's creation, already at moderate risk, and will be at high risk, even at 1.5 degrees. And the main reason we worry about this is because damage to these areas may trigger feedbacks. I remember hearing at a Royal Society lecture when I was pregnant with my first child, who is now at university, that the Amazon might dry up at 3 degrees temperature rise. Someone in the audience asked the question, surely that means curtains, and the panel did not disagree. The best paper on this came out in August last year. It's from the Stockholm Resilience Centre, which has some of the top scientists on climate. And they looked at these various feedback mechanisms that happen as temperatures rise. And all these different coloured areas show potential biogeophysical feedbacks at various temperature ranges. I don't know, can you read that? The yellow is sort of 1 to 3 degrees. And each of these systems have a temperature at which they degrade, and when they degrade, they increase temperatures still further. And what this paper suggests is that even a warming into the range of the yellow, so that's the Paris targets basically, could lead to a tipping in the mid and high temperature clusters by cascade effects. And the IPCC tends to model linear and well understood effects, so it does not deal fully with these feedbacks and is thus terribly conservative in its conclusions. The authors suggest there is a planetary threshold beyond which the domino of feedbacks occurs. So the biggest question for humanity really is, where is this planetary threshold? The authors say that, this is a quote, the human emissions of greenhouse gases are not the sole determinant of temperature on Earth. Our study suggests that human-induced global warming of 2 degrees may trigger other Earth system processes, often called feedbacks, that can drive further warming even if we stop emitting greenhouse gases. So what we do not yet know is whether the climate system can be safely parked near 2 degrees, as the Paris Agreement envisages, or if it will, once pushed so far, slip down the slope towards a hothouse planet. The authors say it is critical that the world's societies make deliberate decisions to avoid the risk of hothouse Earth and maintain the Earth system in Holocene-like conditions. They propose an alternative stabilized Earth pathway that takes you to a stable place, and that should be done by active planetary stewardship. It's almost a word of speaking to people of faith, I think, there. We are pretty much at the crossroads here. The authors say that after the Earth system is committed to that hothouse Earth pathway, the alternative stabilized Earth pathway would very likely become inaccessible. And that means that... Next one, please, thanks. It's not enough that we do our best. We have to do what's required. And that's, I think, what a lot of people, when you start talking about climate change, if you don't get that, you don't get the problem where we are. So next slide, thank you. And this is what is required. When I write to my MP, he always replies that we're doing our best here in the UK. And what people often mean by that is that we're stabilising emissions or dropping them slowly in this country because we're exporting all our manufacturing. What people often mean by that is that we're stabilising emissions. But in fact, we're not even doing that. I know it looks like we're stabilising here, but that doesn't include 2018, where actually global emissions rose by 2.7%. And of course, we're not doing our best. Just one example is the amount the global economy subsidises fossil fuels. It's $500 billion per year globally. And the UK is $15 billion of that. And actually, the UK is one of the few countries that actually has increased its financial support to fossil fuels in recent years. And this is what conventional campaigning has achieved, you know, rising emissions, basically. And this is what's required to get to 1.5 degrees, where we're pretty safe from all these feedbacks we're talking about, hopefully safe from the feedbacks we're talking about. We need to get down 45% drop by 2030. This is according to the IPCC. And the top blue line there is where we're heading at the moment. The light blue area just beneath that is where we will go with current pledges and targets. So you can see that currently no policies, targets, or even pledges can take us anywhere near where we need to go. And we don't need to nudge things along. There can be no smooth transition from coal to gas to renewables. This is a complete reformation of the global economy that we need to happen. We absolutely need to carry on with all the things we're doing already. I'm not saying we don't do them. But we also hugely need to ramp up the action, and we need to do something differently to what we have done up to now. Next slide, thank you. This is the same sort of data presented differently. We're sort of at 1 degree at the moment, we're in the green, according to this chart, and 1.5 is where we're heading. But as you can see, the difference between the policies we have now, where we're going, and the targets and pledges isn't actually that different. And do remember that looking at these numbers actually are IPCC numbers, and they do not include the cascading feedback effects mentioned earlier. So once we're past 1.5, 2 degrees, these error bars, basically those blue error bars, will go off the scale. Antonio Guterres says this. I have asked you here to sound the alarm. This is what he said this last September. Climate change is the defining issue of our time, and we are at a defining moment. We face a direct existential threat. Climate change is moving faster than we are. If we do not change course by 2020, we risk missing the point where we can avoid runaway climate change with disastrous consequences for people and all the natural systems that sustains us. And he's going to be one of the best briefed people in the world on this stuff. The climate scientists are getting more and more desperate as their warnings are not heard. This is one of the top climate scientists, Professor Hans Schellnhuber. He says, climate change is now reaching the end game. The issue is the very survival of our civilization. And Kate Marble of NASA says, as a climate scientist, I'm often asked to talk about hope. Climate change is bleak. Let's have a happy story. Give us hope. The problem is, I don't have any. And she goes on to say, we need courage, not hope. So how do you feel? I've got to admit, I found it quite hard to write this talk. I had to write it in the mornings, not late at night. So if you're feeling any of these things, you're not alone, and it means you're human. But what do we do with these feelings? We can succumb to despair or denial. We can whistle a happy tune and pretend that easy solutions are in our reach. And I think both are understandable, but are they the healthy way to go, and are they what God is calling us to? And I think the third option requires us first to grieve. And if you're ready to acknowledge that grief, there are places to go. Green Christian is setting up a new project to, which actually has its first meeting tomorrow, called Borrowed Time, which is trying to help people through climate grief. And I have some small handouts about that to hand out later. Andrew Boyd, who wrote something called The 12 Characters in Search of an Apocalypse, one of the characters asks himself this: do we dedicate ourselves to an impossible cause, or do we pull back and look after our own? The choice, once you've sat quietly with this question, is clear. You must dedicate yourself to an impossible cause. Because as Archbishop Oscar Romero said when asked why he was attending to the sick at a hospital for incurables, we are all incurable. Because solidarity is a form of tenderness. Because this simple act of caring for the world is itself a victory. We must take a stand, not because it will lead to anything, but because it is the right thing to do. We never know what can or can't be done, only what must be done. So I'm now going to talk about some things we can do, which are, for me, really help. And who knows, we might actually change the course of history. Firstly, personal stuff. Who here has done a personal carbon footprint calculation? That's right. If you ever want to fly on holiday again or enjoy going to a barbecue, don't do a carbon footprint calculation. Campaigning. Operation NOAH has a campaign to divest the church, and Green Christian has got lots of resources to help raise the awareness about the seriousness of the climate emergency. There is an Ethicists Without Borders statement that they are hoping church leaders can sign up to, which is on the Green Christian website. For me, I don't spend too much time now on the lower level campaigns. It's too late for nudging, really. I think every opportunity I have to speak, I feel I must speak the truth. Even though, you know, the plastic stuff and the recycling, I still do it, but I don't campaign on it. And it's just something that's part of my integrity, trying to live the right way. But I don't spend, you know, I've got this lovely water bottle that somebody gave me. But I don't spend a lot of time thinking about acting on plastic and that sort of thing. Thank you, yes. The way the science looks, business as usual is finished one way or another. We have a choice of either carrying on until our civilization falls apart, or we choose a better way now. And if I ask myself, what would it look like for us to choose that better way that would stop uncontrollable climate warming? I think it would involve people realizing just how desperate the situation is and be prepared for a complete unprecedented turnaround of the current economy. That would be a total transformation beyond anything we've done before as a species. We'd have to overcome vast vested interests and ignorance. So how to make people realise where we are and what needs to happen when we have no time to spare? In the past, mass civil disobedience has changed societies dramatically and fast. The theory is that if enough of us rebel against the current destructive system, just perhaps, God willing, we could change the course of history. When Joy asked me to do this talk, I said I could no longer do talks where I do not talk about Extinction Rebellion, because otherwise I don't see there's hope. Without Extinction Rebellion or a miracle, or perhaps they are the same thing, I don't see how we can have a hope for a safe future. So with prayer and rebellion, hope is conceivable. And at Christian Climate Action, we think that if God plans to save creation, how is he planning to do it? And if we are his hands and feet, what does that mean? If this is it, then, you know, what does that mean for us? What choice does it leave us, in a way? But more than the hope of results is simply the requirement to act in a way that is commensurate with the seriousness of the crisis, whether or not there is hope in success. This is a definition of nonviolent direct action from Martin Luther King. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks to so dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. And there's theory behind it, just as well. Non-violent campaigns are twice as likely to be successful as violent campaigns, and violent campaigns are three times more likely to be unsuccessful, just as well. Because obviously for Christian Climate Action, the methods that we use must be in line with the teachings of Jesus. And the theory goes that we only need 3.5% of the population on the streets taking direct action for campaigns to be successful, with about 30% of people sitting behind at home just in support of them quietly. So 3.5% is 2.3 million, I think. So Extinction Rebellion was born last summer, and its three most important principles are non-violence and telling the truth and acting as though that truth is real. It has some eminent supporters. In a letter to The Guardian last autumn, this letter was signed by 94 academics, including Rowan Williams. They said, "We will not tolerate the failure of this or any other government to take robust and emergency action in respect to the worsening ecological crisis. The science is clear, the facts are incontrovertible, and it is unconscionable to us that our grandchildren and children should have to bear the terrifying brunt of an unprecedented disaster of our own making. Our government is complicit in ignoring the precautionary principle and in failing to acknowledge that infinite economic growth on a planet with finite resources is non-viable. Instead, the government irresponsibly promotes rampant consumerism and free market fundamentalism and allows greenhouse gas emissions to rise." And they go on to say, "When a government willfully abrogates its responsibility to protect its citizens from harm and to secure the future for generations to come, it has failed in its most essential duty of stewardship. The social contract has been broken. It is therefore not only our right, but our moral duty to bypass the government's inaction and flagrant dereliction of duty and to rebel to defend life itself." The church has a high respect for the law, and rightly so, but sometimes it seems right to ask ourselves whether obeying God's law requires us to do things that might be interpreted as breaking the law of the land. Can civil disobedience sometimes be divine obedience? In the past, it has been right to break the law to achieve justice. This is bigger than justice. This is about survival. And we follow someone who didn't always make his point through legitimate avenues. So Extinction Rebellion, I've got a couple of slides about what they do. It's all about telling the truth in powerful ways. They held a funeral last autumn for Our Future, which was incredibly moving, actually. It's a way of speaking the uncomfortable truths to our generation. There's also disruption and rule breaking. This gets attention and costs economically and makes elites sit up and take notice and gets us in the press, which is a way of getting the truth out there. And sometimes, for Christian climate action, it's simply praying in unusual places. And something I think the graphs earlier showed is that the only thing that humanity needs to do to destroy God's beautiful creation and civilization is to just carry on going about our ordinary law-abiding business as usual. And this was one way of resisting that, standing and later praying on a train at Canary Wharf in the financial district, which we see as the temple for the idol of economic growth, the worship of which seems primarily responsible for the destruction of God's creation. Is it working? We always say at Christian Climate Action that we're called to be faithful, not successful. But it's quite nice when you find that you are successful, even in a small way. I've been working, campaigning on climate change for 20 years, and I haven't been the only one. There's been a lot of us. And after 2 weeks of Extinction Rebellion shutting down London, the UK Parliament declared an environment and climate emergency, which was the first ask of Extinction Rebellion. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. They haven't done anything yet, but they've said they're going to, which is better than they've been before. So also the language has changed. This thing about telling the truth, they've achieved. People are using the word climate crisis, climate breakdown, climate emergency, all over the place. It's just people are beginning to tell the truth about where we are. After Easter, 90 councils declared a climate emergency. And on June, there was an increase in the public's belief on the necessity for civil disobedience. On the 5th of June, a YouGov poll showed concern about the environment at highest level on record. So this is obviously not just Extinction Rebellion, it's Greta Thunberg, David Attenborough, the Committee on Climate Change. But they actually said that undoubtedly this is boosted by the publicity raised for the environment cause by Extinction Rebellion and the activism of Greta Thunberg. Some other opinion polls, when asked by Opinium whether they agree with we are facing a climate emergency, 63% agreed that we are facing a climate emergency, with 25% strongly agreeing. I mean, this is all just after the rebellion, so it might have dropped, but it shows we have to continue. The ComRes found that when asked whether climate change threatens human extinction, 54% agreed, with only 25% disagreeing. Opinion polls also found the statement, I would be willing to make personal sacrifices for the climate as long as I knew others were doing the same. 66% agreed with that. So the way I see it, already Extinction Rebellion is making it politically possible for the government to do what if it listens to its advisors, must know it needs to do. And who do you think said this? This was, no, nearly. Boris Johnson said this. So it's nice to make a difference, but you know what? Our chances of success are still small. Which brings me to my last slide, actually. Next one. Thank you. And I don't know what these words mean in the face of an ecological and climate breakdown, but I do know it must be right to do all we feel called to do, and to trust these words, and to rely on God, to take our loaves and fishes, and to do what He will, do what He will with them. So I'll read these as the final quotes. So what you do in the Lord is not in vain. This is from N.T. Wright. Sorry. You are not oiling the wheels of a machine that's about to roll over a cliff. You are accomplishing something that will become in due course part of God's new world. Every act of love, gratitude, and kindness that makes the name of Jesus honored in the world, all of this will find its way through the resurrecting power of God into the new creation that God will one day make. And Romans 8, I have to hang on to. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Thank you. Can I sit down, will you?
This is working. Is this? Can you hear me? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ruth. That was very interesting talk and gave us lots of food for thought. I just wanted to say very briefly about a time many years ago, when I was in Greenpeace. Some of you didn't know that. And I didn't actually go on the demonstrations in London, but Greenpeace were petitioning the government to allow and to increase money for local councils to recycle waste, and for people to do that, collect their waste, etc. And I had friends who said to me, this is a load of rubbish. People, it won't happen. People are not like that. They will not do that. But of course, people do recycle their waste. They do collect it. And it is happening because people are like that. So thank you. And now we're going to have some questions. I know several people who want to participate, and we've got questions or thoughts. If you would prefer to just give your opinion about something, not too long.
Thank you. So, hands up, please.
Well, I didn't see anyone first.
Thank you. Can I say thank you to our speaker, because I admire your courage and your involvement in trying to raise this issue. I'm intrigued by the Bible verse that you drew from Romans, but our mandate goes back to Genesis, even before we had children, that we were to look after this planet. So part of my question, but my observation is, why is the church so late on coming on board when we should be leading it? But my problem tonight, in a sense, and I'm all for ecology, and I encourage my church to challenge people throwing rubbish down, because sometimes you get a bit of bad vibes coming back at you, of course. But I have this paradox. Not so far back in history, someone discovered oil. And now, if you could give them a time machine, shoot them across to 2019, and say to them, they could see the problems with burning fossil fuels is this. What would you say to them then? And another observation is, some of the ecology around the world requires fire. Now, you have to go with barbecue, you all have to go with barbecue. Requires fire to self-generate, regenerate for the future. All that resource of fossil fuels, we have to wave our fist to God and say, you really lost it. You've given us this awesome resource, and now we know we shouldn't be using it. That's the paradox. Do you have anything to say on that?
I totally agree. The church should be leading the way on this, and that's what I've been, that's been my passion, really, for half of my life, I suppose, trying to get churches to lead on this. And people, you know, there are a lot of Christians that understand it, but that there is a lot, there are still a lot of people that haven't quite got it, and I understand that. I hadn't got it. It wasn't until my 30s that I made the connection between my faith and my care for the environment. I just didn't make the connection until I was my 30s. So I totally understand people who haven't got it, but now I've got it. Yeah, it is my passion, and it is a shame that we're not leading the way more. Oil and gas, I don't know. It's a values thing, isn't it, I think. It's also a population thing. I mean, you know, you could say that God's first commandment was asking us to, you know, breed all over the world, because so we tick that one, you know, we've done that, we don't need to do that anymore, so because all the pollution is obviously multiplied by the number of people that pollute, so it's partly just too many people on the planet, I guess. And also just the economic system, isn't it? So even if we weren't using fossil fuels, yeah, just putting everything in as a slave to this economic system, that we have to have economic growth. You know, we have to have economic growth on a finite planet. Even if there wasn't fossil fuels, like, I would be surprised if that would work, you know.
I would say partly an observation in answer. We know we are given things that we must not use.
Yes.
There's not only the lesson, for instance, in the poetic language of the apple on the tree in the Garden of Eden, which we were given, mm-hmm. and which we were supposed not to use, the way Israel chose a king, mm-hmm. which they were really not supposed to do. And for whoever lived through the 1960s, we armed ourselves with enough weapons to destroy ourselves. Mm. We have them, and we must not use them.
Yeah.
I think this is part of being the grown-up human race.
Yes. Very good.
Just a quickie, really. Could you explain or expand a little bit about this divest your church when you were saying what people can be doing, please?
Yeah, it's sort of trying to get the church to lead the way and take a prophetic stance. Is it because... it's trying to get the church to lead away and take a prophetic stance on the climate. At the moment, the churches have investments in fossil fuels, and the idea is that we should divest completely as a moral statement that we do not want to be making money out of destroying the future. Some churches have divested and some haven't, and some have partially divested, and some have said they will divest if the oil and gas companies don't get their house in order. And it's just, it's not really clear what that means. There's information at the back there. There's a leaflet called Fossil Free Churches that has all the information to help you understand what that's all about. Thank you.
I have probably two points to raise. The first is, what are your opinions on carbon offsets with flights? Do they work? The other is, do people have a sense of hopelessness when they see the effect that they might have individually against the effects of large grass and forest fires, volcanic activity, the effect of third world trying to catch up with the first world in terms we've had our industrial revolution, now it's their turn. And in my discussions with friends, there's just this sense of hopelessness. Mm. Look at what we're doing. It's like nothing compared with volcanic activity, natural fires, and so forth, and of course what's going on in third world countries.
Yeah, with all this, the personal stuff, I don't fly. I mean, the offsetting thing, the world's not big enough to plant enough trees to offset all the flights It's just that we just don't have the space. So it doesn't work. I mean, whether it's better than fly, if you're going to fly anyway, it's probably better to offset it. But then that might mean you fly next year. So, yeah, you know. So, yeah, personally, all the stuff you do personally is sort of between me and God, really. It's not, I don't expect it to make a difference. It's about living in the right way. And even just little things. I remember watching a Christian Aid video once years ago about a woman that didn't have running water. You know, had to go, you know, it was about getting money for her to have a well or something. And I just remember, you know, I turned my tap off while I'm brushing my teeth, simply because of seeing that woman in solidarity with that woman, not because it makes the slightest bit of difference whether I turn my tap off or not. So it's a different reason for doing that. So you can't expect the little things you do to make a big difference. Because if everyone adds up all the little things they do, I'm afraid it adds up to a little thing. You know, we need to do big things. Like, sorry, the barbecue wasn't against barbecues, it was against meat, sorry. Do a carbon footprint. You'll do a carbon footprint and you'll see that, you know, if you want to make a big difference to your personal effect on God's creation, the two things is meat, dairy as well, but I'm afraid I eat some dairy, but you know, it's meat and flying are the two big things. And in terms of being hopeless about it, yeah, that's what Extinction Rebellion gives you. They have a theory, you know, who knows, it might work, who knows, God knows exactly.
Just follows on really from what the gentleman was saying. I don't know whether you heard, it was about 10 years ago, that the destruction of the rainforest has been going at such a rate, putting so much carbon into the atmosphere, that in 1 year, all the carbon that's been put into the air in the history of aviation and projected 25 years into the future was equal to 1 year's burning of the rainforest. Now, we're 10 years further on now, so perhaps we can say it's all the carbon put into the air in the history of aviation plus the next 15 years. Now, if we're thinking about these small things, the tiny things you can do, and I would say anyway that God calls us to be stewards, good stewards, not to be greedy, but to be good stewards. So some of these things we're talking about, like eat less meat, take fewer flights, these are not the things to be looking at. It's the big things. How can we stop this terrible destruction of the rainforests? And there was something on the BBC, I think a couple of weeks ago, at least they were drawing attention to it. So this would make a colossal and a huge difference.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
Yeah,
I totally agree. I totally agree that would make a huge difference. But I'm also, and that's the sort of thing to pray for, isn't it? And it's the sort of thing to lobby for if you can, and give to the charities that protect those areas. At the same time, I'm a citizen of the UK, so I feel I'm morally obliged to tell my MP and my government what it should be doing in this country, because that I'm a citizen of this country. And this country is no excuse for putting $15 billion a year, increasing the subsidies to fossil fuels at this time. They just, you know, so you have to, you know, it's that circle thing, isn't it? It's the sphere of influence, or sphere of control, and sphere of influence, and, you know, you've got your own life, and then you've got your church, and you've got this country that you are a citizen of, and your job is to tell the government what you think about this stuff. And then you've got the rest, and that's sort of up to God, really. It's really important, I totally agree, but you can't control everything.
Well, it comes down to what Mother Teresa said, that every drop, the ocean is made up of drops, and so each one of us does have an effect. And there's lots of things these days we can do. There's organisations like AVAS that put pressure on, like the South American governments and others, to actually, and they are quite successful in fighting some of these large multi-global industries. And the more people around the world that support such organizations to campaign basically against the destruction of the rainforest, the expansion of oil and gas in North America and things like that, everybody's little vote or everybody's little campaign adds up. The other thing I'd like to ask you about was under the picture that you had of Rowan Williams, you had a quote. Was that his quote? Whose quote was that? Is that Extinction Rebellion or what?
It was a letter written by 94 academics, including him.
So it was
to the Guardian.
It was actually what they signed up to.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So this is a very practical question. You had some very interesting slides. It was incredibly difficult to take it all in and certainly impossible to make notes on all of it. Is there some way of having access to those, please?
Yes, I think we were going to put them on the...
The church website.
Church website, yes.
If you look at the boards, it's one of the pieces of paper tells you exactly how to do it.
Right,
how
okay.
How to access it online. Church website.
Thank you.
Nobody's mentioned it in church.
Right.
Oh, can we... One more?
What is your position on fracking?
Sorry, I'm here. Sorry, what is my position?
What are your thoughts on fracking? Since we have it quite near us, I think, in Hawley somewhere.
It's a fossil fuel that needs to stay in the ground. It's just, you know, we should be leaving everything in the ground. We shouldn't be looking for new reserves of anything, for goodness sake. I was arrested with Caroline Lucas, actually, at the Balcombe fracking site. We went to court with her and got found innocent, actually. It's just, crazy. It's just not what we should be doing at this time.
Okay, last one now.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot about how important it is to do things to change the system rather than work within the system.
And I'm wondering, if I joined Extinction Rebellion, is there a Christian section within Extinction Rebellion?
Yes. Christian Climate Action is basically the Christian... I mean, there's lots of Christians scattered about, actually. It's amazing how many Christians are in Extinction Rebellion, but we do have a little affinity group that's Christian, which is Christian Climate Action, and actually I could hang these out now, which has our website, and do join up. Yes.
Okay.
So, sort of hand these out. These are sort of little things to do, really, just ideas of places to go and things to do. And I don't know how many to send them around.
Right, we have a poem now. A poem from Nick.
Right, this is a poem by Daniel Berrigan called Sun. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. "It's too much," they cried. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. "I've had it," they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. "Why do you stand?" they were asked. "And why do you walk?" "Because of the children," they said, "and because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread."